Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey. Over the past decade, more than 100 hospitals in rural parts of America have closed. At least 20 of those hospitals are in the Midwest, including one in Streator, Illinois, about 50 miles north of Bloomington. In some cases, that hospital may be the only one in town, and the ripple effects are enormous, affecting not just access to healthcare, but also the town's economy and even identity. A new podcast from Kaiser Health News and St. Louis Public Radio explores the fallout after a small town loses its hospital. The podcast is called Where It Hurts, and I'm joined now by host Sarah Jane Tribble. She's senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Sarah Jane, welcome to The 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Christine.
So to tell the stories in this podcast, you actually went home to Kansas, specifically to Fort Scott, a city in the southeastern part of the state. What's that town like? What brought you there?
So to explain why I went home, my mom actually called me about this hospital closure. I grew up about an hour south of Fort Scott. So if you're going from Kansas City, Kansas or Missouri, and driving south, you drive through Fort Scott to get to my hometown area. And I went home because I had a lot of questions. I've been a healthcare reporter most of my 20-some careers in the world of journalism, and I know that rural hospitals have been closing across the country. I also knew that this particular hospital was owned by a company out of St. Louis, Missouri, that it closed a hospital in 2015, also in southeastern Kansas. So it seemed like a trend, and I had a lot of questions.
Yeah, a concerning trend. And when you arrived, what was your goal at the start of your reporting process?
So my goal in December 2018 was to talk to the hospital president before the hospital completely shut down. And so I went there a few weeks before the hospital closed on December 31st, 2018. And I wanted to talk to her about why that was happening and the impact on the community. When I sat down with her, one of the things she told me was that there were zero patients in the beds the weekend before I arrived. Absolutely no patients in the beds.
I want to get into more of what you learned, obviously, what people can hear in this new podcast. But before we get into that, can you tell me a little bit about the people, the residents of Fort Scott, Kansas, and also just generally what the area is like?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite topics. Obviously, I grew up in the region, so I have a big affection for the region and the people there. And they're a tough people. They're Midwesterners. They don't complain much. The town itself is very historic. It has a fort in it. Fort Scott's named after the fort that was created before the Civil War. It was along the border of the Missouri-Kansas border during the Bleeding Kansas days. Long, rich history. And so some of the podcast explores that a little bit. The hospital was actually founded 130-some years ago. When it closed, it had been open 132 years. And it was founded by the Sisters of Mercy Nuns. And the town really identified with that hospital. It had been part of their community so long. It was the only, really kind of the only healthcare provider in town in many ways. It had the home health agency. It provided the ambulance at the Friday night football games. It was the name that was known. You could find its advertisements on like local restaurant menus.
Hmm. So I want to play a portion of your conversation with a woman, one of the women you spoke with named Pat in the first episode of the podcast. But before we get to that, can you tell me a little bit about Pat?
Yeah. So I ran into Pat on Main Street outside of a used bookstore, Books and Grannies, and Pat was smoking a cigarette on a wooden bench. And that was my first encounter with Pat. And she was dressed up that day. She had bangles on her arms and wearing a flowery dress. But she's in her 60s. And she was telling me that when the hospital closed, her husband was having heart problems again. And she's really kind of an example of some of the struggles in southeastern Kansas and a lot of rural America. This is a place where there's an aging population. There's lower incomes. Often poor people live in rural areas, and they lack access to easy transportation and reliable transportation. And Pat was just telling me, she didn't even tell me her name at first. She started talking about some of her problems paying her bills, being able to afford food while paying for medicine and things like that. And so she was very direct and and just a pleasure to talk with, actually.
And I understand when you were speaking with her, you noticed a bit of a rattling sound coming through your mic, and it turns out it was just the sound of her lungs from her having emphysema. Let's dive into that part of the podcast. This is from episode one of No Mercy, the first season from the new podcast, Where It Hurts.
Because I have emphysema. That's what I'm dying of. That's why I'm losing weight.
It literally sounds like a creaking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear it?
No, I don't hear it anymore.
I've been sitting here thinking something was on my mic, but it's your...
I'm sorry. No, I don't hear it anymore. It's been too many years. I don't hear it anymore.
You're dying? What do you mean you're dying?
I'm seriously worried for Pat.
So you, when you walked in, Roxine said you've been losing weight again. So
yeah.
why are you losing weight? And that's not a good thing at 65, is it?
No, it's not. No, it's not. It just... Well, whenever I look at myself, I see my dad and I watch...
Pat sees her father when she looks in the mirror. He lost a lot of weight and then died from a heart attack. Pat is already so thin, and she says it's difficult to eat or really do anything these days.
It was a nice cushion knowing that the hospital was there if we needed it. If my husband needs it. If I get out of breath and can't catch my breath. You know, or I have my heart attack from my heart having to work so hard.
Is that what you're expecting? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a clip from the new podcast, Where It Hurts. I'm speaking with Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Sarah Jane Tribble. She's the host of that podcast. Season one is titled No Mercy. Sarah Jane, when I hear Pat explain her situation, I just can't help but think if the only hospital in your community is forced closed, that can be a matter of life and death, no? I mean, what would a person like Pat do if she did have a heart attack?
Right. So they would call the ambulance, and the ambulance would then either drive to an emergency room, a standalone emergency room, or drive to another town to the hospital. And I phrase it that way because for a couple of weeks, and we explore this in the podcast, Fort Scott went without an emergency room. And when rural hospitals close down, often the towns go without an emergency room. But what that means is, you know, the ambulance comes and picks you up and you drive. And the longer the drive, the worse the outcomes, right? And there's been research on that. In the case of Pat right now, because the emergency room, the standalone emergency room is open, they would take her there, but they would probably stabilize her and move on. People in Fort Scott have called it a Band-Aid station. And it's better than nothing, but if you do have to be admitted or if you do need a cardiologist, you're going to have to travel more. And that can take a toll on your health and in your survival rates.
So, Sarah Jane, can you walk us through what happened that ultimately brought the hospital to the point of having to close? What were the circumstances, I guess, in the town and then also specifically for the hospital?
Right. So I'll start with the town. So a lot of rural America is losing population. And Fort Scott has lost population slowly over the years. It's never been a massive community. It's at 7,800 residents right now. And so that loss of population has affected who uses the hospital. And then when you add, in addition to that, that you've got an aging population as well with more needs, you've got a what we call in the business payer mix, right? So the amount of money a hospital can make off of private insurance and then federal programs like Medicaid and Medicare varies. And if you have more of the federal programs and not private insurance, you don't make as much money, generally speaking. In Fort Scott, what had happened over the years is the president tried to save the hospital and keep it going as long as possible. Is she would go out to the Rotary Club and tell people to use the hospital, come use our skilled nursing unit, come do this, and we'll take care of you. But at the same time, the local businesses were vying for the best health insurance they could get. And often that meant high deductible health plans. And so if you had a health plan with one of the private employers in town or the school district, it could have a $2,500 to $5,000 deductible on it that you would have to spend down before you had your insurance coverage. So if you think about it, she's out there asking people to come to the hospital because even the ones with private insurance were bypassing and driving past the hospital to shop for better prices for things like MRIs and CAT scans and other services.
Wow. And from your reporting on rural hospitals more broadly, is this a trend you see in lots of places? Is this a common story when we hear about a rural hospital closing, that there were a lot of these similar circumstances?
Right. So it's sort of a two-step process, right? So I was talking to Mark Holmes, who's the head of the Shep Center at the University of North Carolina. They study rural hospital closures. And he was telling me that there's a ripple effect, right? Once the hospital starts to close services, like say its intensive care unit, then it can't bring in those doctors. If it closes certain surgeries, then you don't need pathology anymore. So people, it tumbles down upon itself. You can't use the hospital if it doesn't have the services that you actually need. And then that accelerates the loss of revenues for the hospital. And so that did happen at Mercy and has happened. He said that's very common across the U.S. as hospital presidents try to save and hang on as long as they possibly can.
So when it became official and when Mercy Hospital announced they were closing, what was the reaction that you heard from the people in the town?
Well, this is, I think, one of the most intriguing parts of this story, if you listen to the podcast. So if you think about it, Mercy had been around 132 years. Rita Baker, the president, was sort of a homegrown CEO. She grew up south of town on a farm, and she had been at Mercy more than half her life. And she was beloved in the town. But once she announced the hospital closure, people were very upset, very angry. They didn't understand. And that's a real tension point, if you will, in our podcast.
Yeah, and we actually have a cut of tape from Pat, the woman we heard from earlier. Let's take a listen to that.
Yeah, I don't understand how they can just so blatantly close the hospital. I mean, I understand dollars and cents, but at the same token, where is the humanity? You know, what are people like us supposed to do? Whenever you can't even afford to go to the grocery store to buy a gallon of milk.
I mean, so you can just hear the emotion in her voice, and it sounds like you're saying this was a common sentiment.
So I think Pat represents a certain segment of the community in Fort Scott. And I say that carefully because the data shows that about one out of every four children in Fort Scott live in poverty. The average median income there is, household income is lower than the rest of the state. And so there are people who are struggling. There's also people who are doing quite well in Fort Scott, and they also love the community as well. We try to show all aspects of that in the podcast.
I want to take a listen to another clip from the podcast, the snippet where a conversation you have with a man named Fred. First, can you tell us a little bit about him?
Right. So Fred Campbell is the town historian. He worked at the local high school, was an administrator. He grew up and was born in Fort Scott during the Great Depression. So he's in his 90s now, and he loves Fort Scott. But he also has a memory that's that traces the history of Mercy Hospital and the meaning of that hospital to the community. And in current day, when you drive around Fort Scott, you know, Mercy, I think for a lot of us, the healthcare systems we use are sort of faceless businesses, right? We know we're going to go to this, you know, testing center, lab center, we're going to visit our doctor at this outpatient center and what have you. But for the people in Fort Scott, Mercy was something that their parents grew up with, and every kid had been born there. So Fred really puts that in perspective. He remembers the nuns who worked at the hospital, and he just has a hard time accepting that the town can't support a hospital.
And let's just listen to a bit of that exchange. This is a clip from the new Kaiser Health News podcast, Where It Hurts.
It's all very painful for Fred. We spoke for hours, and you can tell he's been turning the closing over in his mind.
One of the hardest parts of it all, too, is to drive by and see the trucks backed up, loading out the equipment to take to other Mercy hospitals as they clean this one out of any and everything they could.
Near the end of our visit, Fred wants to know if I think there's any chance that Mercy will come back, or maybe there's another hospital that will take over the now empty building. In my mind, the answer is no. Rural hospitals nationwide are closing, and I'm certain no one wants to take over this one. But this gentle giant of a man can't believe that Fort Scott, his once vibrant railroad town, has fallen on such hard times that it can't support a hospital. I don't want to hurt Fred, so I don't answer his question. Instead, I hedge and ask him one more question before I leave. What would he ask Mercy if he had the chance?
Are you getting out too soon? That'd be my question. With our history of, as a community and supporting your efforts, Mercy Corporation, can you stay with us longer and see if we ourselves can't be sustainable with your help?
Sitting there in the visitor's chair, I promise to find a nun and ask.
So hearing Fred's voice, it's pretty clear. He wanted to know if there was any hope at reversing course. Was there anything that could have been done to keep the hospital afloat?
Well, a lot of folks in the community believed that there was, that something could have been done, and that they have plenty of money and jobs in that community to support a hospital. But when you talk to the former president, Rita Baker, she said there was no way. She served on community boards, and she knew what the condition of tax revenue was in the community and in the county, and she knew what it would cost to keep that hospital open. And it's a massive building. It's larger than 3 football fields. They built it in the early 2000s. It was for sort of a different time period, like a lot of these rural hospitals across the U.S. They're built for people staying in their rooms and staying overnight and having more services in the hospital, whereas in today's world, you know, we don't even stay the night for a broken arm, right? And back in Fred's childhood, he would have stayed the night. He did stay the night for a broken arm. So hospitals are different now. And they cost a lot to keep open, right? So if you have to have the staff to support the certain kinds of beds that you have, whether it be intensive care or whether they be other floors and units, those cost money to staff. And Rita knew that it would cost too much for the community to support. She also knew from previous conversations that other hospitals weren't going to come in and take it over. And I think the town really believed that somebody might come take it over.
And I definitely want to pick up this conversation on the other side of our break to learn more about what happened next. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Sarah Jane Tribble, host of the new podcast, Where It Hurts. I'm Christine Herman. You're listening to The 21st. This is The 21st. I'm Christine Herman in for Brian Mackey. My guest is Sarah Jane Tribble. She's host of the new podcast, Where It Hurts, from Kaiser Health News and St. Louis Public Radio. The podcast explores what happens in rural communities when the town's only hospital is forced closed. Sarah Jane, we've been talking about Mercy Hospital in Fort Scott, Kansas. And right before the break, you were telling me just about how much it would have taken to keep the hospital afloat and how that really wasn't a viable option. What ended up happening when the hospital closed, and in particular to all the people who worked for the hospital? Were all services cut, or was there some way to salvage what was there?
So we explore this idea in the podcast because Rita Baker, being from the community, didn't want to just walk away and leave it with nothing. She knew the needs of the community. So she tried to put together a plan, and we talk about that and go into it in a bit of detail. More than 200 people worked at Mercy Hospital when it closed. There was a time when it employed hundreds more than that. It was one of the largest employers in town, even in the end. And those people either found a job at the new federally qualified community health center that came in to take over kind of the primary care offices, the kind of outpatient centers that you might go to see your doc for a checkup on a regular basis or take your kid to for a sore throat. She also worked to make sure another hospital would come in and take over the ER. Now, that is a tension point also in the podcast. So we explore that. And so there were steps that she took to make sure there were services there. But even so, I talked to one nurse who had been employed at Mercy Hospital a long time. And And I talked to her several times while she was hunting for a new job, and she just was not getting a job that would pay as well as Mercy. And lots of people took retirement. They took their severance packages and retired, or they went to other Mercy hospitals and found jobs, or they went to other places and found jobs. It's safe to say that many people are traveling out of town to work, and maybe still living in the community, but traveling out of town to work.
Yeah. And in towns like Fort Scott, this probably wasn't the first business to close and for there to be a loss of jobs like this. Does it kind of follow on a longer trend over even decades?
Yeah. So that's kind of the most painful. And it's painful for me personally because I grew up in, you know, an hour away from there. And I saw that happening in the hometown I grew up in as well. You know, these jobs that had been really solid providers for middle-class families just kind of disappeared. In Fort Scott, it was insurance companies. Western Insurance had been based there, and then slowly it just started decreasing over the years. Before the insurance days, it was railroad days. So a couple of industries had come through and decreased to the point where, you know, then it was kind of startup manufacturers and the hospital were the biggest jobs. And, you know, when you go to a small town like this, and I went, you know, a handful of times over the course of the year, everybody you meet is connected to Mercy. Either they worked there, their mom worked there, they had their kids there. In some way, they were connected to that hospital, largely economically as much as anything. So it was a major hit. There's research out there about the amount of money people spend when connected to the hospital. And for example, if a hospital spends $2.30, then it's in the community, it's worth $2.30, right? So there's this trickle down. Like when the hospital has a job, it's usually a well-paying job, and people have more disposable income to spend in the community. It was an economic hit. After the hospital closed, other businesses closed. Now, whether it was directly related or not, that's, you know, hard to track. But, you know, a big grocery store that had moved into the community closed within weeks of the hospital closing. The company says it was unrelated, but at the same time, the hospital closed because of not enough patients. Grocery stores closed because not enough customers. The cancer center that was based in the hospital closed. It was an affiliation. It was an outside organization that had offices in the hospital. The hospital provided those offices. So that cancer center closed, and then the dialysis center closed. So
like a domino effect almost.
Yeah.
So on one hand, you know, as I was listening to the first episode of the podcast, it just made me think a lot about the costs of healthcare. Like, we know that there are problems with healthcare affordability that you've already alluded to. And yet there are smaller hospitals like Mercy and more than 100 others that have closed in the past decade in rural areas that can't stay afloat for financial reasons. Can you explain the disconnect there?
Yeah, I think it really is confusing to the average person, right? You get your explanation of benefits from your insurance company and you see how much money is being spent on the care that you've received. And you're like, where does that go? And private insurers do make up a good portion of a hospital's revenues, but Medicare and Medicaid also make up large portions, especially in rural America, where you have a population that often doesn't have the same income or is an aging population. And so when you look at that kind of federal reimbursement, there's a lot of experts out there and criticism of the way those payment systems work. It is being, you know, there's a lot of red tape to get payment for the care you're providing through Medicare. There's the way the structure is set up varies depending on the kind of hospital you are. A small hospital with 25 beds and less is likely paid a different way from Medicare than a larger hospital with 75 beds. And your payment depends on, you know, what kind of services you're providing, the fee-for-service model. So it may seem like you're paying a lot for your healthcare, but the way hospitals are reimbursed, they may not be getting that money directly.
I'm speaking with Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Sarah Jane Tribble. She's host of the new podcast, Where It Hurts. Season one, titled No Mercy, explores the fallout after a rural Midwestern town loses its hospital. Sarah Jane, I wonder if this reporting changed your understanding of what rural communities like Fort Scott, Kansas, need in order to really thrive.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of through line for our podcast is this idea of, well, the hospital closed. That seems like a really awful thing, but is it? Because if you talk to the president and she tells you people were bypassing the hospital to go someplace else and there were no patients in the beds, you have to ask, well, if they weren't using the hospital, then why are you guys so upset about losing it? And part of it's security, right? And like I said, a lot of these communities will lose their emergency departments too. That's a very scary, traumatic thing. But at the same time, you know, there are solutions out there for communities like Fort Scott. And we talk about those in the podcast. There's white papers and research by the American Hospital Association, and Kansas Hospital Association has been a leader on this. And it talks about, you know, the OB care that's needed, the emergency care that's needed, and really driving home the idea that primary care is necessary in these communities. And that's the kind of bread and butter doctor work that I think we all associate with kind of diabetes care, food coaching, making sure we're getting our chronic illnesses taken care of. That kind of work would really help improve the health of those communities. Pat is one example of how healthcare can suffer even with a hospital. She has emphysema from a lifelong use of cigarettes, right? She does Marlboros. Those are her favorite kind. And that emphysema is something, you know, she would have liked to, you know, quit smoking earlier if she had Chantix. And she said, nobody's paying for that. And she kind of talked to me about that. She's like, you know, they can talk about us not wanting to smoke, but until somebody comes in and helps us not smoke, because it's expensive, Chantix is. And that's an addiction that's really hard to kick on your own. Those kind of services maybe aren't best provided by a hospital, but by a different kind of care group.
That's really fascinating, Sarah Jane, because it sounds like you're saying, like, let's make sure there are emergency services available for those really dire situations, car accidents, tragedies, strokes, childbirth, and obstetrics department. But aside from that, maybe all the other surgical center, other entities of the hospital that can maybe make it very expensive to operate it, maybe those aren't as needed, or at least not as high up on the priority list as what you've been talking about, an emphasis on much more comprehensive primary care and preventive services. Is that a correct understanding?
Yeah, I mean, that would be sort of the takeaway that I took from looking at least Fort Scott and other rural communities, is if you have these health outcome issues, chronic illnesses that lower your love of life, and they lower your life expectancy, actually, people die younger in southeastern Kansas than other parts of the state, then why not go to the core of that and figure out, well, why are people getting sick in the first place? Hospitals are acute care centers, right? If you end up in a hospital, it's because you're really sick and you're already kind of past the point where some kind of preventive measures may have helped you in the first place. So when you're looking at, you know, rural America, yes, we should do something for the hospitals to help the payment system and make it more fair and equitable, and maybe not based on fees of services, but on value of care being provided. But at the same time, we should look at the population and say, what's going to make you thrive? How do we change the payment structure to make sure that we're not spending our dollars, taxpayer dollars, on things that don't work?
And are there places that are doing a good job of that? Have you encountered any of that in your reporting, like a rural area that has kind of figured out the way to do this instead of just putting a Band-Aid on this issue, kind of getting to the root of it?
Right. So there's actually the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has a whole like report on this every year, trying to find communities doing a good job on this. And they've pointed out some communities to me. I have not had the chance to go and explore those as in depth as Fort Scott. But I will say that, you know, health centers that get discount prescription drugs, for example, those would have been touted as part of the solution for this problem.
We just have a few minutes left, Sarah Jane, but I just wanted to ask you if you could comment a little bit about how, just in this political moment that we're in, healthcare has been such a big topic. And a lot of people, as we've been discussing, have real concerns about healthcare access and affordability. I wonder how this podcast fits into that broader narrative of what our society is dealing with right now when it comes to healthcare access and affordability.
Rural hospitals were some of the first to jump at the money that was being given out through the CARES Act from Congress during the COVID pandemic that we're still experiencing. Rural hospitals had to cut back on elective surgeries. They had to furlough staff. They were already short on cash days in hand, which is the amount they have in their savings account. If they don't get paid, they can use that money to pay their employees and stuff. They across the U.S., they were very short on that. In Illinois, for example, there are 74 rural hospitals in the state, and one study that I saw showed 6 vulnerable hospitals, and the average cash on hand days was less than 2 months. So these hospitals in this moment with COVID and the pandemic that's still, you know, hitting hard in the middle of America, they're hanging on. But this is an issue that isn't going away anytime soon.
And Sarah Jane, just one last question before we let you go. What do you hope people listening to your new podcast will walk away with?
Well, first of all, I hope they walk away meeting people that really affect them, right? I hope they say, oh, I relate to that person. I understand why they're in this situation. And they relate to it, because I truly think if we learn the lives of other people and understand those lives, then we will have empathy and we'll know our shared experience is the same. So I hope that happens through the voices and the profiles that are given out in this podcast. I also hope that we do ask critical questions like, well, if we can't save the hospital, what can be done? I hope those questions lead to some solutions for communities out there.
That's Sarah Jane Tribble. She's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of the new podcast, Where It Hurts. We'll tweet out more information if you follow us at 21STShow. We'll also post it to our website, 21stshow.org. Sarah Jane, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Christine. It was a pleasure.
Before we go, I want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We've been hearing interesting things from listeners, and it's informing our coverage. You can join us by texting the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just follow us, search for the 21st at 21STShow. We tweet out links with more analysis and background about what we've been talking about. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Search for the 21st. That's the 21ST. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan is our engagement producer, and our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Brielle Skullark, and Chantel Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey. Thanks so much for joining us.